So we take up item number one, which is an action item. I invite Justices Miller, Hull, and also Judge So, O'Malley, and Herman.
Thank you, Chief and Judicial Council members. Last August, the Chief Justice assigned the internal chairs the task of coming up with a new open meetings rule for the judicial branch. And again, just before we begin, Chief, I want to let you know that we appreciate this. Contrary to the rumor, we don't bear any ill will towards you for assigning us this task. I hope you'll believe that.
Before you go further, I want to say I am grateful for the extensive time all of you put in, and I know it was not always easy and harmonious nor unanimous. And because we have such transparency and access, I heard about it all. So I thank you for your hard work through a difficult issue. Thank you.
I appreciate that, and that's why I made the comments, because, you know, the rumor was we didn't get along, but we did get along with everybody but Marianne.
And your point is.
All right. This is a serious topic. We believe that the open meetings rule marks a new era for the judicial branch in California and sets a high bar for the judicial branches in other states. For the first time, it will establish a requirement of open meetings for more than 20 advisory bodies and many, many more subcommittees. I have no doubt that this will be a challenging and learning process. But it's a big move, and it's a big move in the right direction. And quite frankly, a direction that was set by you very early on. When you became Chief Justice a little more than 3 years ago, you immediately opened up the branch, made it more transparent, including opening up the Judicial Council meetings that were once closed. So if I could, I'd like to start with the PowerPoint. In June, and I want to give you a little background and a little history, and I know some of you have heard this, but I want to make sure that for those who are listening in or who may be here, that you'll have the opportunity to hear it from its inception. And I do want to thank sincerely all of the internal chairs that I had the opportunity to work with on this process, because we met in person many times, we had video conferences many times, telephone calls, Justice Hull, Judge Herman, Judge Marianne O'Malley, and Judge Ken So, they did a great job. And at the end, I want to thank Debbie Brown's staff, because without them, we couldn't have got where we are. But I want to name them personally at the end. All right. In June of 2013, language was added to a budget trailer bill that would have required the Judicial Council to adopt a rule of court opening to the public all meetings of all committees and all other advisory bodies that report to the Council. The trailer bill language would have given the Council until October 1st, 2013, about 3 months, to draft and adopt the rule. Governor Brown vetoed the trailer bill language after the Chief Justice suggested that the judicial branch should have the opportunity to develop its own rule, expanding public access to advisory body meetings while recognizing the uniqueness of the judicial branch and the judicial branch needs. After the governor's veto, the Legislative Analyst Office published supplemental report language on the topic. Supplemental report language is adopted by the legislature. It includes statements of legislative intent and requests for follow-up reporting. It does not go to the governor for review and is not subject to veto. The supplemental report language directed the Judicial Council to report to the Joint Legislative Budget Committee by January 1st, 2014, on implementation of an open meeting rule. It also included the following statement about the content of the rule, quote, "The rule shall apply to any committee, subcommittee, advisory group, working group, task force, or similar multi-member body that reviews issues and reports to the Judicial Council," end of quote. After the governor's veto, the Chief Justice asked the chairs of the Judicial Council's five internal committees to conduct a comprehensive review to determine how the Council might most effectively expand public access to committee meetings. The five of us have been working since August of 2013 on that project. In doing so, we considered the supplemental report language and the open meetings laws that apply to other governmental entities. The legislators' open meetings law, the Bagley-Keene Open Meeting Act, which applies to state bodies in the executive branch, and the Ralph M. Brown Act, which applies to legislative bodies of local agencies. We also considered the rules of court, particularly those that apply to the Judicial Council meetings, and we considered the California Code of Judicial Ethics, which governs the conduct of justices, judges, court commissioners, and other judicial officers who volunteer their time to serve on Judicial Council advisory bodies. We were also guided in developing the rule by the following factors: the public's interest, the important public interest in having access to meetings of Judicial Council advisory bodies to better understand the work that they do and to provide input, important input, before proposals are finalized for presentation to the Council. The public's interest in having an effective rulemaking process that will produce fair, innovative, workable, and fully conceived proposals for Judicial Council approval to further equal access to independent and impartial justice statewide. We also considered the unique limits that the California Code of Judicial Ethics imposes on judicial officers who volunteer, again, volunteer to serve on advisory bodies. And lastly, the practical realities of limited financial and staffing resources following several years of significant reductions to judicial branch funding, something which we've dealt with over the last many years. In developing the rule that we recommend today, we also sought input from many sources, and we did some unique things in that regards. We spoke with Judicial Council Advisory Committee chairs and lead staff. We met with various court leaders. We developed a preliminary draft of the rule and held two briefings at the state capitol on it for legislative staff, for labor representatives, and for the news media. We also held a press conference to answer questions. We added in an extra step also, providing a special opportunity for the public to provide input about the preliminary draft of the rule. That was from November 14th to November 20th. After we considered those comments, we made some changes to the draft rule, and we posted the revised version on the California Court's website, formally inviting public comment. The comment period ran from December 20th to February 7th, 2014, 7 additional weeks. We received many responses. In response to the formal invitation to comment, we received written comments from 17 sources. Some of the commentators shared short technical suggestions. Some raised discrete practical concerns. Some were detailed and lengthy, addressing the provisions of the proposed rule line by line. In content, they ran the gamut from you went too far to you didn't go far enough, across the spectrum. We received comments from three leaders of the state assembly, a joint letter from Perez, Speaker of the Assembly, Wykowski, Chair, Assembly Judiciary Committee, Jones Sawyer, Senior, Chair, Assembly Budget Committees, Subcommittee Number 5 on Public Safety, from the news media, the California Newspaper Publishers Association, Courthouse News Service. We received comments from labor, from SEIU, California State Council, Councils 36 and 57 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, from Advocates of Open Government, Californians Aware, First Amendment Coalition, and from a nonprofit law firm, Public Counsel, and from members of the public. We received comments from within the branch, from the Superior Court of Los Angeles and San Diego and San Mateo. We received comments from three Judicial Council advisory committees, civil and small claims, criminal law advisory, and probate and mental health advisory. All of the comments were excellent. All of the comments reflected care and thought, and we carefully considered all of them, and we made adjustments to the rule based on many of them. Now we present to you the final product, which we recommend the Judicial Council adopt. You've all had the opportunity to read the report and the attached rule with the comment chart. We will cover key parts of the rule now, noting some of the adjustments that we made based on the public comments received. So let's look at the rule. We begin the rule with a statement of intent, subdivision A. It is written both, first, to confirm the purpose of the rule, expanding public access, and second, to educate. We wanted to let the public know right at the outset that the rule is just another step that the Judicial Council already has established, a framework that seeks public input and that gives the public access to its work and the work of its advisory bodies. With that in mind, Subdivision A provides the intent of the rule is to, quote, to supplement and expand on existing rules and procedures, providing public access to the council and its advisory bodies, and the rule expands public access to advisory body meetings, end of quote. Then the rule provides a definition of the term advisory body. In Subdivision B, the rule states that advisory bodies mean, quote, any multi-member body created by the council to review issues and report to council, end of quote. We added an advisory committee comment for this definition because, as used in other rules of court, the term advisory body does not include the internal committees of the Judicial Council. And for purposes of this rule, Rule 10.75, the term does include the internal committees, advisory committees, and most of the subcommittees. It includes, and this is under covered bodies, Subdivision B, it includes subcommittees that are composed of a majority of the members of an advisory body. It also includes all standing committees that are charged with addressing a subject as a continuing matter. Subdivision C1, it describes the meetings that are open under the rule. It directs that meetings, quote, to review issues that the advisory body will report to the Judicial Council are open to the public except as otherwise provided, end of quote, in the rule. This specifically includes budget meetings. Under the rule, a budget meeting is a meeting or portion of a meeting to discuss a proposed recommendation of the advisory body that the Judicial Council approve an allocation, and again, the key words, approve an allocation or direct an expenditure of public funds. The rule directs in Subdivision C1 that advisory body budget meetings are open. On the other hand, some advisory body meetings do not involve a review of issues for report to the Judicial Council. For example, some meetings provide education for members or a forum in which colleagues from locations throughout the state can exchange information about best practices. These exchanges foster statewide connections among colleagues, providing more resources to help court leaders in performing their jobs and are vital to collaboration and effective leadership within the branch. So the rule strikes a balance between one, allowing public access to meetings in which advisory bodies develop proposals to present to the council, allowing public input in that context, while two, preserving an area for advisory bodies to meet out of public view to develop relationships, receive training, and share resources. I want to talk a little bit about exempt bodies, Subdivision C2. The rule completely exempts the meetings of three bodies, the Judicial Council's Litigation Management Committee, the Advisory Committee on Civil and Criminal Jury Instructions. These committees exclusively consider topics that are uniquely difficult or impossible for judicial officers who are members to discuss in public due to the detailed ethical standards governing the judiciary. The meetings of these committees will always be closed, and they are not subject to other rule requirements, for example, about posting notices or agendas or creating minutes. In addition, six committees that are charged with developing rules of court are subject to the rule, but their meetings are expected generally to be closed. Budget meetings, again, would be an exception. If a rule committee holds a budget meeting to discuss recommending that the Judicial Council, again, using the terminology, approve an allocation or direct an expenditure of public funds, the meeting must be open to the public. The six rule committees have many members who are judicial officers and thus are bound by the California Code of Judicial Ethics, which limits the comments they may make in public. These comments also consider topics that are uniquely difficult or impossible for judicial officers who are members to discuss in public. Just to review, the six rule committees are the Appellate Advisory Committee, Civil and Small Claims, Criminal Law, Family and Juvenile Law, Probate and Mental Health, and the Traffic Advisory Committee. I should note that unlike the three exempt committees, the six rule committees are those subject to the rule. Although they will generally hold closed meetings, they must comply with rule provisions, for example, by posting meeting notices, agendas, and preparing minutes. Some rule committee chairs and staff expressed uncertainty on this point, so we have reworked the language to make sure that it's more clear. The ultimate goal is to provide some information for the public about the work of these committees while still allowing them to have full discussion of evolving law without worry that judicial officers who participate may be violating ethics rules, unique to the judicial branch and unique to judges. We made another change after further consideration following the comment period. We removed the Rules and Projects Committee, an internal committee, from the list in Subdivision C3 of those that will ordinarily hold closed meetings. We concluded that RuPro discussions usually occur at a different level, at a policy level. Members have fewer occasions to discuss pending cases or specific legal issues that pose ethic challenges if discussed in public. The chairs of the rules committees also, though, have the discretion to open a particular non-budget meeting or a portion of that meeting. In other words, to have it in an open setting. Although we have just discussed some committees that will continue to have closed meetings, it's important to note what this rule opens. For the first time, it will establish a requirement of open public meetings for more than 20 advisory bodies and many more subcommittees. This includes some committees that already have held public meetings and many others that have not. The Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee, the Court Facilities Advisory Committee, the Judicial Council Technology Committee have held open, successful meetings. Like other open meeting laws, the rule also would allow advisory bodies to close part or all of a meeting to discuss certain topics. The list of closed subjects is provided in Subdivision D. In composing it, we relied in part on topics identified in other open meeting laws. The list includes, for example, topics that implicate privacy concerns, discussion of pending litigation, discussions of negotiations, discussions of non-final audit reports, and trade secrets or privileged or confidential information. The rule also allows a closed session to discuss, quote, topics that judicial officers may not discuss in public without risking a violation of the California Code of Judicial Ethics, necessitating recusal or encouraging disqualification motions or peremptory challenges against them, including proposed legislation, rules, forms, standards of judicial administration, or jury instructions. It's interesting. A number of commentators were concerned about this provision. They suggested that advisory bodies instead rely on other provisions in subsection D to close a meeting, or that judges might simply refrain from comment to avoid ethical issues. They also suggested that a risk of an ethics violation should not suffice to justify closing a meeting. We saw it differently. Advisory body members who are judges are chosen for appointment to those bodies because they have special knowledge and experience in the area that the body will address. They are key members of those committees. The public interest is best served, and I stress best served, by having their full and active participation. If we do not have the provision, many judicial officers, already very busy with their day jobs deciding cases, may decide not to participate, and the public ultimately will lose a tremendous resource. Judges' comments during public meetings also can be taken out of context, misheard, or misunderstood in a way that may spark challenges, creating workload issues at their local courts. The rule also provides directions on the mechanics of conducting an open meeting. Subdivision E talks about public notice. Notice must be posted on the California Court's webpage 5 business days before an open meeting. If urgent circumstances require prompt action, however, an open meeting may be conducted on 24 hours advance public notice. Note that the notice and agenda requirements apply to all meetings subject to the rule, whether they are open or closed. This includes closed meetings of the rule committees listed, as I mentioned earlier, in Subdivision C3. Again, we clarified this point as we understood there was some confusion. Subdivision I addresses public attendance at open advisory body meetings. It confirms that the public may always listen to open meetings by telephone. If members of an advisory body gather in person at a single location for a meeting, the public may attend in person if the chair concludes that appropriate security measures permit such attendance. As you can expect, we got some strong comments on this provision also. Other open meeting laws require that the public be permitted to attend all open meetings in person. If members join a meeting by telephone, other laws require they do so from locations where the public also may gather to listen in and give comment. As we've explained in the report, unfortunately, we are not able to offer this option. Advisory body meetings typically occur by telephone, before or after a daily court calendar, or during the noon hour when judges, attorneys, and others who work in the courts can make time to join. Members join from their individual locations, most often a private office or a judge's chambers across the state of California. We do not have the budget to pay the travel costs that would be involved if members gathered in person for each and every meeting. We also do not have enough meeting space or committee staff to handle public attendance and comment sessions. So the rule provides for public attendance by telephone, the same method that the members use, the members of the committees use to join most meetings. Subdivision K ensures the opportunity for public comment for open advisory body meetings. It establishes that written comments will be welcome for all such meetings. To be considered for a specific meeting, written comments would need to be received one complete business day beforehand. If the public is attending a meeting by telephone rather than in person, comments must be submitted in writing. This is necessary because advisory bodies do not have the staff or the budgets to arrange for the multiple phone lines that would be needed to manage public comment periods. Also, advisory body phone meetings must cover a number of agenda items in a relatively short period, and the business could not be completed if a spoken comment period is added each time. If the public is attending in person, however, then the public must be permitted to speak about agenda items. A member of the public would only need to sign up to speak at the meeting before it begins. There's usually only one staff person at each advisory body meeting, and that person is working during the meeting, and so it is not able to greet late arrivals to check whether they want to speak. The rule also allows an advisory body to take action by email between meetings in two circumstances, two only. If the advisory body discussed and considered the proposal at a previous meeting but concluded more information was needed, or if the chair concludes prompt action is needed. If the email proposal concerns an open session topic, the advisory body generally must provide public notice and allow one complete business day for public comment before acting on it. If the email proposal concerns an open session topic, advisory body members may not talk with each other about it until the body has acted on the proposal. Their communications with each other about the proposal must be by email. The limit on talking with each other about the proposal applies from, one, the time the proposal is distributed to all members, two, the time that the body acts on the proposal. Rather than talking, members must communicate with each other about the proposal and vote on it by email. This creates a public record and thus a level of transparency. Written minutes must be prepared describing the action taken on an email proposal for an open session topic. The minutes must attach any public comments received. Once approved, the minutes must be posted on the California Court website. Finally, in response to a number of comments expressing a concern about the absence of an enforcement mechanism, we added Subdivision P. It would require the Judicial Council to review the rule's impact within 1 year of its adoption and periodically afterward. This will give the council the opportunity to consider whether changes are needed. In conducting this review, as listed in this subdivision, the Judicial Council will consider, among other factors, the public interest in access to the advisory body meetings, the judiciary's obligation to comply with judicial ethics standards, and the public interest in the ability of the advisory bodies to effectively assist the council by offering policy recommendations and alternatives for improving the administration of justice. In the meantime, our work's not over. We are working with staff to develop guidelines for the proper and consistent application of the rule to help committee chairs and staff and to provide uniformity, predictability, and equality of access for the public. Finally, I'd like to add that although we consider this rule to be the best we could produce in light of all the competing interests, we also recognize that in some ways it's a work in progress. The rule represents a sea change for the judicial branch. We will have to change our business practices to accommodate the rule. We, the Judicial Council and staff, will likely be challenged by the demands of the new rule. And as I've indicated, yes, it will be a challenge, but I sincerely believe it is the right and appropriate thing to do. As I said earlier, we have been guided to this point by the leadership of the Chief Justice. And again, with regards to transparency and issues of openness, I commend you, Chief, for the direction that you have given us and the example you have set for us and for all Californians. And then lastly, I would be remiss if I didn't thank Debbie Brown and her LSO staff, and particularly Deborah Morrison, Lyndon Nguyen, Patrick O'Donnell, and also Pam Reynolds. They were wonderful. I can't tell you how many times I received emails over the weekend and at 10 o'clock at night from them, and they did a great, great job. And are there any comments that any of you would like to make?
Thank you, Justice Miller, Chief, ladies and gentlemen. I did want to take the opportunity to make a comment or two before we turn this matter over to the council for its discussions. As Justice Miller mentioned, we started this effort at the urging of the legislature and the governor's office last summer. And I was originally of the mind that we should limit our rule to matters relating to finances and budget. It seemed to me that the impetus behind the movement towards this rule was largely based upon wanting to know not how the branch spends its money, because that is public knowledge, but wanting to know how the branch decides how to spend its money. And I suspect in some circumstances some hope that there could be voices added to those decisions from outside the advisory committees and the council. And so at the time, I did not think that we should have a rule that called for open meetings of advisory committees that did not involve budget discussions. Even so, I was persuaded, as we talked, I was persuaded that a broader rule would ultimately benefit the branch. And as Justice Miller has said, you now have before you the end result of our labors. It's my understanding that perhaps only 6 of the 50 states in the United States have open meeting rules that relate to the judicial branch. The others do not, and judicial branch meetings, as I understand it, are closed. But I firmly believe, as I believe all of us do, that the citizens of California have a right to know how their government operates. They have a right to know how the executive branch operates. They have a right to know how the legislative branch operates. And they have a right to know how the judicial branch operates. But in my view, that right does not extend to the establishment of rules that would significantly interfere with the judicial branch's ability to carry out its constitutional duties. When in a little while we are called upon to vote on this proposal, I will vote in favor of it, but I still have some reservations, and I just wanted to mention 2. One of the reservations, a reservation that I do not have, excuse me, is one that would suggest that the council and its many advisory committees have anything to hide. I've been on the council now for a little bit over 3 years, and we have nothing whatsoever to hide. But there are 2 that I thought I would mention this morning. And as Justice Miller has already mentioned, one of them has to do with judicial ethics. We're all familiar with Canon 3B9, which says that a judge shall not make a public comment on any pending or impending matter. And all of us who have served on advisory committees, or those of us who have come to know the work of advisory committees, know that much of what is done and discussed in those meetings could be construed as a comment on a pending or an impending matter. Opening those discussions to the public could lead to a claim that these judges so commenting have violated Canon 3 with the attendant consequences. I believe we also need to be alert to Canon 3B1, which reads, a judge shall hear and decide all matters assigned to the judge except those in which he or she is disqualified. In other words, a judge, as we all know, is, or any judicial officer, is ethically obligated to decide the cases assigned to him or to her unless there is a disqualification. If certain discussions during advisory committee meetings, meetings that are public or otherwise, would suggest that taking a position on a certain legal issue may lead in turn to a demand that that judicial officer recuse himself or herself from certain proceedings, sort of a self-imposed disqualification, I suppose, that would prevent him or her from being true to Canon 3B1. Now, contrary to what some have suggested, this is no small matter. The voluntary participation, as Justice Miller mentioned, of literally hundreds of judicial officers who volunteer their time in the work of advisory committees are absolutely critical to the work of the judicial branch in providing access to justice for Californians. If, due to a concern that participation calls upon the judicial officer to violate the canons of ethics, that voluntary participation may become seriously diminished, and the necessary work of the branch will then be severely compromised. A rule that has that effect has gone too far. Thus, we have subdivision D10, which Justice Miller pointed out to you, which bears repeating, and D10 will allow closed meetings when there is discussed topics that judicial officers may not discuss in public without risking a violation of the California Code of Judicial Ethics, necessitating recusal or encouraging disqualification motions or peremptory challenges against them. And I am confident that the advisory committee chairs will be vigilant to this problem and exercise their authority appropriately. Secondly, I have some concerns the rule may adversely affect what we like to refer to as frank and vigorous discussion within the advisory bodies. And this is no small matter either. Perhaps coincidentally, I was doing some research not long ago on the law, and I came once again to the case, the United States Supreme Court decision in United States against Nixon, decided in 1974, found at 41 Lawyers Edition 2nd, 1039. Excuse me. As you will recall, this was the litigation that arose out of the subpoena to the president for the audio tapes of discussions that he had been having with his advisors, which in turn arose out of the Watergate scandal. The president had asserted on a number of grounds that the subpoena had to be quashed. Chief Justice Warren Burger, writing for a unanimous court, at page 1062 of that decision, observed, quote, in support of his claim of absolute privilege, the president's counsel urges two grounds, one of which is common to all governments and one of which is peculiar to our system of separation of powers. The first ground is the valid need for protection of communications between high government officials and those who advise and assist them in the performance of their manifold duties. The importance of this confidentiality is too plain to require further discussion. Human experience teaches that those who expect public dissemination of their remarks may well temper candor with a concern for appearances and for their own interests to the detriment of the decision-making process. Whatever the nature of the privilege of confidentiality of presidential communications, in the exercise of Article II powers, the privilege can be said to derive from the supremacy of each branch within its own assigned area of, of constitutional duties. Certain powers and privileges flow from the nature of enumerated powers. The protection of the confidentiality of presidential communications has similar constitutional underpinnings. Interestingly, at this point, Chief Justice Burger set forth a footnote, and he pointed out that there was nothing novel about governmental confidentiality, further noting that the meetings of the Constitutional Convention of 1787 were privately held, noting that all records of those meetings were sealed for over 30 years after the convention and that most of the framers of the Constitution acknowledged that without secrecy, no Constitution of the kind that was developed could have been written. Now, I'm not suggesting that we are anywhere near that point. I simply point out those comments by the Chief Justice as to these matters as validating a concern that while we have open meetings, we also have the necessary latitude in our discussions to make the decisions that we need to make. I think that the people's right to know has to be balanced against the confidentiality necessary to the effective and legitimate decision-making ability of the judicial branch. If for the judicial branch this rule sacrifices the latter in favor of the former, then the rule has gone too far. And in that regard, I will note once again what Justice Miller noted, that in subparagraph subdivision P, we will review the rule in its actual workings. And if in practice the rule has indeed gone too far, we'll amend its provisions such that the judicial branch is able to continue to effectively carry out its constitutional duties. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Justice
Hall. So we're open to questions? A motion?
Comments?
Judge
Rosenberg. Thank you, Chief. Well, this is quite an endeavor. I'm really intrigued by the fact that there's so few judicial branches in this country that have an open meeting rule at all. So I guess my first question is a little speculation on your part. Why do you think that is? Why is it that once we adopt a rule, we'll really be in the minority in terms of open meetings and open discussion?
I can't speak for all 44 of the other states, but it is my understanding that there are a number of states who have judicial branches who simply take the position that what they do in their meetings is not any business of anybody who is not involved in the decision-making process. That sounds harsh. I don't agree with it, but I think there are some who take a very, very hard line in that regard.
I also think it's because California's been the leader and the model in developing the judicial branch. I'm not sure how many of the others have as a significant working body as the Judicial Council here and the various discussions and decisions that we're called upon to make, and that have the number of advisory bodies and task forces and working groups that we have. And so I'm not sure that they've gotten to that point where they had to think about it in that regard.
I'm not sure if this is totally responsive, but based on my discussions and experience in the Conference of Chief Justices, each state is so uniquely created with their judicial branch. In some, the Chief Justice, it's a top-down organization. The Chief Justice is the governor of the branch, and he or she makes the rules and orders it applied. And in some, the chief's position is the Supreme Court runs the branch. And in some, they have judicial councils that are not nearly as, I would say, robust and overseen by actual hands-on work of judges. I will tell you, when I go to West Virginia in July to attend the Conference of Chief Justices, I'm a board member, I will tell you two things. First, I will be presenting on collaborative courts, which, if you think about that, presenting it amongst the country on California, we're a leader in that too, but this will be a topic of conversation because other states have confided to me that they watch what California does. They watch California and they watch New York.
Chief?
Yes, Judge Walsh.
I'd like to thank the five internal committee chairs for doing a difficult job balancing the demands of the legislature and others with your deeply held concerns and ours that too much openness will have a chilling effect on the fine work that's been done for years, that's given us that reputation for being leaders in the country. I'm all for openness. The Judicial Council has been open for some time. The advisory committee charged with working on the budget headed by ably by Lori Earl and Zacho Theodorovich, has been opened. The main change that this proposed rule brings is opening up all those other advisory committees. And I think the comments in opposition to this rule that claim it's not open enough suffer from a continuing misunderstanding of our advisory committees. These are not committees of voting members of the council. They consist of staff and essentially user groups, non-judicial council members, judges, attorneys, and others, who then work up issues to present essentially as staff memos or staff reports to the voting body, that is, the Judicial Council, where there will be free and open discussion of the issues. To require opening up such staff functions, even though there's judges on them, those are not Judicial Council voting members, to open those up goes well beyond Begley-Keene, well beyond the Brown Act, and I believe is inappropriate and unnecessary. But I support this rule, not because it's necessary for appropriate democratic transparency. I don't think it is. We already have that. But I support it because if we do not pass this rule, those in Sacramento who continue to misunderstand how our branch functions will, based on that misunderstanding, impose something even more inappropriate. So again, I thank the five internal committee chairs for a tough job. Well done. And I support this proposal. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you. Justice Ashman Gerst.
I just have a comment and then just a final question. And, you know, just want to express my feelings. I mean, I commend the five chairs of the internal committees and all the staff who worked so hard on this proposal. It was grueling and complex, but I have some concerns as well. Well, you know, we all believe in transparency, and certainly this chief has done everything possible to encourage it. I'm concerned that we've gone too far as a first step. I mean, I know I wasn't present at the meetings with the legislature when this was first discussed, and I certainly appreciate that. However, I've been involved in drafting legislation for many years at the AG's office and the city attorney's office, and I just wonder if we could have just started smaller. I kind of feel like we're negotiating against ourselves with this proposal. You know, my thought was that the legislature was most concerned about budget and technology, basically because of CCMS. They're not, for example, worried about how RuPro approves changes to the jury instructions. I'd love to make them listen into that kind of thing. I've heard several times that the rule can be modified in the future, but when have we ever seen something this comprehensive become less inclusive? Seriously. And, Harry, I know that you just said you considered just beginning with the budget, and I would think maybe we could have done budget and technology because those seem to be the issues that were the most concerned to them. So I worry that rather than being all-inclusive, that is, all budget and tech, what we've done is it seems like we've set forth these numerous exemptions, and that's been subjecting us to criticism, that we have all these exemptions. So those are just my general comments about it. And the one question I do have is, how will this B10 be raised? I mean, is it going to be at the time that we're having a meeting and someone says, hey, wait a minute, that's an issue that deals with perhaps a pending legislation or, you know, pending case or whatever, and then we're going to close the meeting? I mean, how is that actually going to work?
I think it will arise in many different occasions, and hopefully in the development of the agenda, which has to be posted, as I believe, 5 days before, that will all be taken into consideration, and the agenda will indicate what part is closed and why it's closed. It may require consultation with LSO to make those determinations. I think that's one aspect. And yes, I think there may be occasions where something will arise at a particular meeting where it may need to be discussed at that point, and the discussion terminated and a conversation held with LSO to determine whether or not one of the exemptions may apply. And on your first point, and I don't want to speak for others, but we received comments in that regards. We certainly discussed that, but I think ultimately, after we got done with all of our discussions and looked at a small rule or a broad rule or a more narrow rule, we thought we should write the best rule we can, which deals with all of our circumstances, and do it in a way that covers all the different aspects.
Judge Rubin.
Thank you, Chief. I don't mean to cut off discussion or anything. That's not my point here. People worked really, really hard on this. I went to a couple of those regional meetings where it was discussed and watched all the stakeholders participate. I would just like to move adoption of the rule.
Additional discussion?
Yes.
Well, I'll second the motion for discussion.
And there'll be additional discussion.
Exactly.
Judge Rubin moves. Judge Rosenberg seconds. Judge Brandlin, you have the floor.
Thank you, Chief. First, I wanted to commend the committee members on a job well done. This is a lot of work, and it shows great balance. I share Justice Hall's concerns that have been stated with regards to the breadth of certain open meeting requirements. But I have a question, and maybe the committee members wanted to try and address that issue. Although it doesn't happen often, what happens where you're in a presumptively open meeting that needs to be recessed for a period of time because additional information is needed? There's an agenda that's posted, there's a delay for public input, and then there's an exchange by emails between the members of that advisory group, task force, or committee. On pages 57 and 58, in the report, it describes the notice and the email issues and the communication cycle and the official record. And in the last sentence of that paragraph, it reads, quote, "The emails exchanged concerning a proposal that otherwise would have been considered in a closed meeting will constitute the official record of the proposal." So my question is, email exchanges between the committee members in that follow-up meeting, I assume if the meeting itself is open and it addresses that agenda item, that the emails are also considered part of the minutes and the record. Am I correct there?
I don't want to answer for anybody else, but first, the section that you are reading from in the rule is O4, and this is one we struggled with a great deal. If you remember, it had a different topic, circulated proposals, and there was a great deal of confusion about this, both in the branch and outside of the branch as to what it meant. And all of us have served on advisory committees where at the last minute it's, you know, 1:25 and you need to get something to the council or to RUPRO or to EMP and you need more information. And we've done those by email. We've also had times where there needs to be an adjournment and some kind of prompt action taken, and we do that by email. You only have one more day before the ENP has to post the agenda, and you need to get further information or something like that. So O4 doesn't apply to any other provision. It applies to those two circumstances under O when you are able to do that additional work by email.
Okay, and I guess the difficulty I'm having is the terminology. Otherwise would have been considered in a, quote, closed meeting. In essence, if the email exchanges are part of the discussion, would the email exchanges be presumptively part of the official record and open for public inspection? I assume so, although the language is confusing.
So, go ahead.
It's still subject to 10.5.1. And the minutes will summarize substance.
Okay. So would the actual email exchanges be included or just a discussion for a summary?
This is a...
Can you come up to the podium? Thanks, Deborah.
Sure. So the minutes would reflect the action that is taken by email. It would not attach the the email text, but those emails would still be judicial administrative records and open to public access to the extent that the rule requires 10.500, the rule that deals with judicial administrative records.
Okay.
If it's a closed session topic, then the minutes consist, you know, comprise the record, but they may not be subject to public access.
Thank you.
As Justice Miller mentioned, we spent a lot of time on this, and it came up as something that really is not very often at all significant. We've all been part of meetings where we get to the end and we need a little bit more information, or we need maybe a thought or two from LSO, and we say, well, why don't you circulate that, and then we'll make a final vote. And usually, in my experience, it may be different on other committees, but in my experience, it's usually, here's the additional information, and then the chair says, you know, asks the committee members if they now approve of the motion that sort of was, in a sense, tabled. And they, in my experience, normally the email reply is, I agree, or I approve, or yes, or that's fine, or motion carries. The difficulty that we had was there were those who commented who were afraid, obviously not believing in our good faith in this matter, but who were afraid that we could have this swallow the rule, that we would have some discussions on some topic, adjourn the topic, and then over the next 2 days or 3 days or 2 or 3 weeks, communicate by email where we were actually making the decision, and so that they were closed out of their ability to listen to the decision-making process. This is going to take, this is, Justice Miller mentioned it, for all of us, it's gonna, sea change is entirely appropriate, and I think that, I mean, even small things, like I know I am guilty oftentimes of, you know, banging out an email that maybe I've got a misspelling in or maybe a word not properly done, and, you know, to think that all of these at some point may have to be produced under Rule 10.500, it gets your attention. But I think for Judge Brandlin's question, I think this is just the best compromise we could come up with under the circumstances.
You know, we probably spent so much time on this one, and it doesn't happen all that often, but when you read it, it sounds ominous. I mean, you can't talk to each other, and your emails are going to be posted, and things of this nature. And we at one point thought, well, then maybe we just ban these types of meetings all the time. But again, in some sense, even though it doesn't happen on a regular basis, it's part of how we've done business for a long time. And it arises and it's necessary. So we tried to narrow it as much as we could and to make that compromise.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you, Judge Brandlin. Let me say several things before I call for any further discussion. Well, the first thing I want to say, not because I'll forget it, but because it bears statement now, and that is, you know, Jody Patel is integral to all of our initiatives, all of our projects. And I know that she's been in there with all of those meetings with you. And so I wanted to point out and thank Jody for her marshaling and stewardship and the organizations of the meetings and the feedback and the connections that she makes for all the legal experts in the AOC. And, you know, Jody's so often with us in all of these kinds of conversations, we forget she's there because she's always there. So I wanted just to make sure that in this discussion, I know that all of you have had regular contact with Jody on a daily basis, and I thank you for your stewardship in this effort as well. So first, let me say that I'm grateful to the governor for listening to me about the need for the branch to create its own rule. I certainly understood the legislature's demand for what they perceived as a need for greater access, despite the reports that we issue, despite the relationships that we have in order to pick up a phone and call and get information, because the AOC is, if not goes, bends over backward to provide you with information, charts, and numbers, as all of us know. But I'm grateful to the governor for understanding. I think this is my speculation, that as a lawyer, he understood my plea for letting us do this ourselves because of the different, criteria, the different challenges we face in our profession with our canons and this code of civil procedure and the rules and the ethics, etc. And he gave us that opportunity, fully expecting a product, and the legislature as well. And there was discussion about the scope and the depth and how far out and what shall we cover. But always in the back of my mind, whether right or wrong, I felt that if we didn't do this in the way the branch does, in a due diligence, hands-on, good faith effort, that we would be finding ourselves in a year from now in the legislature trying to hold something back. And yet I knew 3 years ago that this council, these chairs, we talked about opening meetings. The trouble is that in the last 3.5 years, we never quite finished that conversation because we were hit with so many financial crises that this wasn't something we didn't get around to it. We just didn't get around to it. It was up. It was our discussion. Doug was working on that with the chairs. We were talking about opening our meetings. We just never got there because of other intervening, superseding causes of fate. So it brought us here to create this rule. And, you know, and on a lighter side, you know, I don't know who outside the branch really understands, except lawyers and judges, how nitpickingly, painstakingly judges, justices, and lawyers go after rules. You know, to do it by committee is, in my experience, 20 years as a judge and a justice, it's almost impossible to come up with something. All of us know how hard it is with all the competing interests and ideas. And so I am grateful for the opportunity for us to craft our own. As for all the comments made here today, I agree with every single one of them. Everyone is right today about what's been said about the bill, about the rule, and our fears and working it out. And I know exactly, Judge Brandon, what you're talking about that email communication. Ask Debbie Brown about my concern and issues with that and what it meant and how broad it was. And all of us as judges and lawyers bring to this rulemaking process the same way that we have reverse engineered, understood the legislature's statutes and intent, and we know how difficult it is. And so I'm grateful for the way these five chairs have gone about two public comments. We are gluttons for punishment. Two rounds of public comment, as well as amendments, as well as working through this in a way that understands truly how difficult, how arcane, how unique the branch is when it operates. We're a statewide branch. We cover 19 million square feet. We're the largest in the country. And we try rulemaking amongst ourselves, and we're hands-on with oversight. So this rule, with all of its detail, truly reflects the sophistication and, I want to say, the unique way we operate as judges involved in oversight of our own business, on our free time. And it's not going to be perfect under anyone's view. But it is a step in the right direction for not only public access, but public understanding of the branch. And that will, in the long run, help us. I have no predictions about where this will go. I'm a little worried about it myself. But I also know that we will review it, and council will take a look with data and make changes as necessary. So in that regard, I want to say that, in my view, this rule reflects what's best about the branch. It's deliberative. It was thoughtful. It was contentious. It sought to cover all possible permutations of how we meet. And it came up with this language, and no one's happy. But it is groundbreaking. And I couldn't have been done without you chairs, without the AOC staff, the legal staff, to help us along in 8 months. And I think it's conceptually something to be proud of. And I don't mean to influence the vote, but I'm telling you this is the history behind where we are and where we could be and where we might be in the future, but for this rule. Judge D'Alba.
Chief, I call for the question.
All right.
Is that a motion?
It's in the form of a motion.
So we have a motion, we have a second, and now I think Judge D'Alba is calling for an end to the discussion to take the vote.
If it's not a motion, then the chair can decide if discussion is over.
I'm going to construe it as a a call for a vote. Thank you. So first I'm going to try a voice vote. So all in favor of the rule as indicated, as set out in your materials, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you. The rule passes.